Chapter 4, My Road of Trials, 1983 to 1994. Coming out of my crash, I was so broke I couldn't muster enough money to pay for an airline ticket to Texas to visit a prospective client, even though the fees I'd earned were many times the cost of the fare, so I didn't make the trip. Still, I gradually added clients, revenue, and a new team. With time, my upswings increased in magnitude and my downswings were both tolerable and educational. I never thought of what I was doing as building or rebuilding a company. I was just getting the things I needed to play my game. Computers were among the most valuable things I acquired because of how they helped me think. Without them, Bridgewater would not have been nearly as successful as it turned out to be. The first microcomputers, what would later be known as personal computers, had come on the market during the late 1970s, and I'd been using them as econometricians did, applying statistics and computing power to economic data to analyze the workings of the economic machine. As I wrote in a December 1981 article, I believed, and I still believe, that theoretically, if there were a computer that could hold all of the world's facts, and if it was perfectly programmed to mathematically express all the relationships between all of the world's parts, the future would be perfectly foretold. But I was a long way from doing that. Though my early systems provided valuable insights into where prices would eventually reach equilibrium, they hadn't helped me develop robust trading strategies. They just showed me that a particular bet would eventually pay off. For example, I'd run through my analysis and end up with a review of the price of some commodities should be, say, 75 cents or so. If it was currently 60 cents, I'd know that I'd want to buy it, but I wouldn't be able to predict that the price would drop to 50 cents before climbing back to 75 cents, and I wouldn't know when to buy and sell. Rarely, but still too often, the system would be dead wrong and I would lose a lot. He who lives by the crystal ball is destined to eat ground glass is a saying I quoted a lot in those days. Between 1979 and 1982, I had eaten enough glass to realize that what was most important wasn't knowing the future. It was knowing how to react appropriately to the information available at each point in time. In order to do that, I would have to have a vast store of economic and market data to draw on, and as it happened, I did. From very early on, whenever I took a position in the markets, I wrote down the criteria I used to make my decision. Then, when I closed out a trade, I could reflect on how well these criteria worked. It occurred to me that if I wrote those criteria into formulas, now more fashionably called algorithms, and then ran historical data through them, I could test how well my rules would have worked in the past. Here's how it worked in practice. I would start out with my intuitions, as I always did, but I would express them logically as decision-making criteria and capture them in a systematic way, creating a mental map of what I would do in each particular situation. Then I would run historical data through the systems to see how my decisions would have performed in the past, and depending on the results, modify the decision rules appropriately. We tested the systems going back as far as we could, typically more than a century, in every country in which we had data, which gave me great perspective on how the economic market machine worked through time and how to bet on it. Doing this helped me create and led me to refine my criteria so they were timeless and universal. Once I vetted those relationships, I could run data through the systems as it flowed at us in real time, and the computer could work just as my brain worked in processing it and making decisions. The result was Bridgewater's original interest rate, stock, currencies, and precious metal systems, which we then combined into one system for managing our portfolio's bets. Our system was like an EKG on the economy's vital signs. As they changed, we changed our positions. However, rather than blindly following the computer's recommendations, I would have the computer work in parallel with my own analysis and then compare the two. When the computer's decision was different from mine, I would examine why. Most of the time, it was because I had overlooked something. In those cases, the computer taught me. But sometimes I would think about some new criteria my system would have missed, so I would then teach the computer. We helped each other. It didn't take long before the computer, with its tremendous processing power, was much more effective than me. This was great because it was like having a chess grandmaster helping me plot my moves, except this player operated according to a set of criteria that I understood and believed were logical, so there was no reason for us to ever fundamentally disagree. The computer was much better than my brain in, quote, thinking about many things at once, and it could do it more precisely, more rapidly, and less emotionally. And because it had such a great memory, it could do a better job of compounding my knowledge and the knowledge of the people I worked with as Bridgewater grew. Rather than argue about our conclusions, my partners and I would argue about our different decision-making criteria. Then we resolved our disagreements by testing the criteria objectively. The rapidly expanding power of computers during the era was like a constant stream of gifts from the gods to us. I remember when Radio Shack came out with an inexpensive handheld chess computer. We sent one to each of our clients with a message and a little sign on it that said, "A systemized approach from Bridgewater." That little computer chess game could kick my ass on level 2 out of its 9 levels. It was fun to put it up against my clients so that they could see how hard it was to beat computerized decision-making. Of course, we always had the freedom to override the system, which we did less than 2% of the time, mostly to take money off the table during extraordinary events that weren't programmed, like the World Trade Center going down on 9/11. While the computer was much better than our brains in many ways, it didn't have the imagination, understanding, and logic that we did. That's why our brains working with the computer made such a great partnership. These decision-making systems were much better than the forecasting systems that I'd been using before, mostly because they incorporated our ongoing reactions to developments, allowing us to deal with a wider range of possibilities. They could also include timing rules. In a January 1987 piece called Making Money Versus Making Forecasts, I explained that, the truth be known, forecasts aren't worth very much, and most people who make them don't make money in the markets. That's because nothing is certain, and when one overlays the probabilities of all the various things that affect the future in order to make a forecast, one gets a wide array of possibilities with varying probabilities, not one highly probable outcome. We believe that market movements reflect economic movements. Economic movements are reflected in economic statistics. By studying the relationships between economic statistics and market movements, we've developed precise rules for identifying important shifts in economic market environments and in turn our positions. In other words, rather than forecasting changes in the economic environment and shifting positions in anticipation of them, we pick up these changes as they are occurring and move our money around to keep in those markets which perform best in that environment. Over the last 3 decades of building these systems, we have incorporated many more types of rules that direct every aspect of our trading. Now, as real-time data is released, Our computers parse information from over 100 million data sets and give detailed instructions to other computers in ways that make logical sense to me. If I didn't have these systems, I'd probably be broke or dead from the stress of trying so hard. We certainly wouldn't have done as well in the markets as we've done. As you will see later, I am now developing similar systems to help make management decisions. I believe one of the most valuable things you can do to improve your decision-making is to think through your principles for making decisions. Write them down in both words and computer algorithms. Backtest them if possible, and use them on a real-time basis to run in parallel with your brain's decision-making. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to 1983. Resurrecting Bridgewater. By late 1983, Bridgewater had 6 employees. Up until then, I hadn't done any marketing. The business we got came in from word of mouth and from people reading my daily telexes and seeing my public appearances. But clearly, there was a growing demand for our research, and I realized we could sell it to supplement our consulting and trading income. So I hired a 7th employee, a former door-to-door Bible salesman named Rob Freed, and we hit the road lugging around a projector, a huge stack of slides, hawking a $3,000 per month research package with my daily telexes, weekly conference calls, biweekly and quarterly research reports, and quarterly meetings. Over the next year, Rob brought in a number of institutional clients and institutional investment managers, including General Electric, Keystone Custodian Funds, the World Bank, Brandywine, Loomis Sales, Provident Capital Management, the Singer Company, Lowe's Corporation, GTE, and Wellington Management. At that point, our business consisted of 3 main areas: consulting for fees, managing companies' risks for incentive fees, and selling the research packages. We worked with all sorts of corporate, financial, and government institutions that had market exposures: banks, diversified international businesses, commodities producers, food producers, public utilities, and more. For example, we built a plan to help a multinational company deal with the currency exposure it faced from operating in different countries. My approach was to immerse myself in a business until I got to the point where I felt that the strategies I was handing off were the ones I would use if I were running the company. I would break each company down into its distinct logical components and then come up with a plan for managing each part using a variety of financial tools, especially derivative instruments. The most important components to separate were the profits coming from the core business and those that were speculative profits and losses coming from price changes. We would do this to show them what a risk-neutral position would look like, which is to say, the properly hedged position one would take if one didn't have a view of the markets. I would advise them to deviate from that position only when they wanted to speculate, which they should only do in measured ways and with the full knowledge of the effects it could have on their core business. This approach was eye-opening to most of the firms that we worked with. It gave them clarity and control and yielded them better results. Sometimes they wanted us to speculate for them, which we would do for a share of the profits. This approach to establishing a risk-neutral benchmark and deviating from it with measured bets was the genesis of the style of investment management we would later call alpha overlay, in which passive bets, in other words beta, and active, in other words alpha, exposures were separated. The return of a market, such as the stock market itself, is called its beta. Alpha is the return that comes from betting against others. For example, some people outperform the stock market and other people underperform it. They are said to have positive or negative alpha. With Alpha Overlay, we were offering a way of making bets independent of underlying market performance. Approaching the market in this way taught me that one of the keys to being a successful investor is to only take bets you are highly confident in and then to diversify them. One of our clients in the mid-1980s was Alan Bond, an audacious entrepreneur who was one of the richest people in Australia. A self-made man, he was famous for being the first non-American to win the America's Cup race in its 132-year history. Like Bunker Hunt, he eventually bet badly and was forced to declare bankruptcy. I advised him and his team on their way up and stayed on through his downfall, so I watched the tragedy unfold from up close. His was a classic case of confusing business with speculation and only hedging when it was too late. Bond borrowed U.S. dollars to buy assets like breweries in Australia. He did that because U.S. interest rates were lower than they were in Australia. Though he didn't realize it, he was speculating that the U.S. dollar, in which he would have to pay back his loans, would not rise. When the U.S. dollar did rise against the Australian dollar in the mid-1980s, and his Australian dollar beer sales earnings weren't enough to pay his debts, his team called me for advice. I calculated what Bond Corp's position would be if they hedged on currencies, and I saw that doing so would lock in losses that would ruin them, so I advised them to wait. When the Australian dollar rallied, I advised them to put on the hedges, but they didn't because they believed the currency problem had gone away. Before long, the Australian dollar plunged to new lows, and they called me in for an emergency meeting. There wasn't much they could do without locking in ruinous losses, so again they did nothing, and this time the dollar didn't rally. Seeing one of the richest and most accomplished men on the planet lose everything made a huge impression on me. We also did one-off consulting projects related to the markets. In 1985, I worked with Paul Tudor Jones, a good friend of mine and a great trader, to design a U.S. dollar futures contract. In other words, a tradable index tracking the price of the U.S. dollar against a basket of foreign currencies. And it traded, and still trades, on the New York Cotton Exchange. I also worked with the New York Futures Exchange to help design and market their CRB, that stands for Commodity Research Bureau, futures contract, which was a tradable index that tracks the price of a basket of commodities. Unlike most people who work in the markets, I never had any desire to build investment products, especially conventional ones, just because they would sell well. All I wanted to do was trade the markets and build relationships, doing for clients exactly what I would do if I were in their shoes. But I also loved building brand new things, especially if they were great and revolutionary. By the mid-1980s, a couple of things were clear to me. First, we were making good calls in the interest rate and currency markets, and the institutional investment managers who were buying our research were using them to make money. Second, we were successfully managing companies' interest rate and currency exposures. With those two things going as well as they were, I figured we could become successful institutional investment managers ourselves. So I made the pitch to the people who ran the World Bank's pension fund, most importantly Hilda Ochoa, who was its chief investment officer at the time. Despite the fact that we had no assets under management and no track record, she gave us a $5 million U.S. bond account to manage. That was a huge turning point for us, as it was the start of Bridgewater as we know it today. The strategy we used for the World Bank shifted between holding cash and holding 20-year U.S. Treasury bonds because these positions would give us leveraged bets on the direction of interest rates. When our systems indicated that the pressure on interest rates would cause them to fall, we would hold 20-year Treasury bonds, and when the system pointed to rates rising, we would stay in cash. We did very well, and before long, other large institutional investors gave us money to manage as well. Mobil Oil and Singer were our next two accounts, and others followed in rapid succession. We went on to become the top-performing U.S. bond manager in the world. Venturing behind the closed door of China. Part of what was great about consulting was that it gave me opportunities to travel. The more unusual a place, the more interesting I found it. This curiosity drew me to Beijing in 1984. The only images I'd seen of China when I was growing up were of masses of people waving Mao's little red book. So having an opportunity to go behind what was still a mostly closed door was alluring. I got the invitation because I had set up a small office in Hong Kong, whose director was an advisor to CITIC, the window company, that was the only business in China allowed to deal with people in the outside world. Beijing was filled with wonderful and incredibly hospitable people who introduced us to the tradition of drinking shots of Mao Tai while shouting Gombei, which is bottoms up, and generally showed us a great time. The first trip, which I made with my wife and a few other people, began an incredibly rewarding 30-plus year journey that had a profound impact on my family and me. There were no financial markets in China at the time. Eventually, a small group put together of seven Chinese companies, including CITIC, known as the Securities Executive Education Council, began to develop them. They started in 1989, just before the Tiananmen Square incident, which set them back because such market developments were still seen as too capitalist. They operated out of a small hotel room and hardly had any financing. I can still picture the big garbage bin under the metal stairway going up to their office. I really respected the risks that these young people were taking by doing this at such an unsettled time. So I made a small donation to give them a hand and was excited to share my knowledge with them. From nothing, these people built China's markets and the government security regulatory arm. In 1994, I set up a small company called Bridgewater China Partners. By then, I was convinced that China was poised to become the greatest economy in the world in the 21st century. But hardly anyone was investing in China yet. Good deals could be struck. I could bring money to the table by introducing my institutional investment clients to opportunities, and I could provide know-how by introducing Chinese companies to American ones. In exchange, we would get a stake in these companies. Essentially, I was setting up the first U.S.-based private equity firm in China. I launched the company by bringing a small group of institutional investor clients who together managed $70 billion in assets to China for a visit. When we got back, we agreed to move forward by setting up a jointly owned merchant bank in Beijing. While I knew that entering a territory where few had been before would require a lot of experimentation and learning, I soon realized that I had sorely underestimated the complexity of the task we had set for ourselves and the amount of time it would take. I found myself constantly on the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to make sense of the shaky accounting and questionable controls at the companies we were interested in. With all of my Bridgewater responsibilities awaiting me when the sun came up. After about a year of this, I could see that running both Bridgewater and Bridgewater China Partners wasn't going to be possible, so I closed its doors. Nobody made or lost any money because I hadn't been comfortable enough with what I was seeing to make any investments. I'm sure that if I had devoted all my time to it, we would have had great success, but then Bridgewater would not have been what it is today. Despite passing up this great opportunity, I don't regret my choice. I learned that if you work hard and creatively, you can have just about anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. Maturity is the ability to reject good alternatives in order to pursue even better ones. While I stepped away from that opportunity, China remained an important part of my own and my family's lives. We loved it, especially the people. In 1995, my wife Barbara, our 11-year-old son Matt, and I decided together that Matt would spend a year in Beijing, attending an all-Chinese school and living with our friend Madame Gu, who stayed with us in America during the Tiananmen Square days, and who Matt had visited in China with us when he was 3. Standards of living in China were very different from what Matt was accustomed to in Connecticut. For example, the apartment Madame Gu and her husband lived in had hot water for showers only twice a week, and the school Matt attended didn't have heat until well into the winter, so the students wore their coats in the classrooms. Matt didn't speak Chinese, and none of his classmates spoke English. All of this was not just a huge adventure for Matt. It was completely unprecedented and required special permission from the Chinese government. I was excited for Matt because I knew he would see a different world and broaden his mind. Barbara needed a little convincing and a couple of visits to a child psychologist for reassurance. But she had lived all around the world herself and knew how it had benefited her, so she was ultimately receptive to the idea, even if she was less excited about being separated from her son. Matt's difficult but life-changing journey profoundly affected his values and goals. Because he fell in love with China, he says he became a bit Chinese that year. And because he learned the value of empathy relative to the value of material wealth, he started a charity called China Care to help Chinese special needs orphans when he was just 16. He ran it for 12 years, and to a much lesser degree still does, while shifting his efforts to reconceive what computing can be in the emerging world, which he is executing through his company Endless. I, in turn, learned a lot from Matt, especially about the joys of philanthropy, and we both learned the deep pleasures of great personal relationships. Over the years, I, and in turn Bridgewater, have also built meaningful relationships with many wonderful people in China and have helped its financial institutions grow from fledgling organizations to sophisticated giants. China wasn't the only country whose people and governments Bridgewater would become involved with. Through their representatives, the government investment funds of Singapore, Abu Dhabi, and Australia, as well as Russian and European policymakers, came knocking at our door. The experiences I've had, the perspectives I've gained, and the help I was able to provide all added up to a package of rewards as large as any others that I'd gotten out of my career. My contact with Singapore's people and institutions also thrilled me. There was, and still is, no leader I admire more than Lee Kuan Yew, who transformed Singapore from a mosquito-infested backwater to a model economy. That says a lot, as I've gotten to know and admire several world leaders. One of my most thrilling moments was a dinner I had with him at my house in New York shortly before his death in 2015. Lee requested the dinner to discuss the state of the world economy. I invited former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, another hero of mine, former Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, whose breadth of experiences gave great perspective, and Charlie Rose, one of the most curious and insightful people I know. Besides answering his questions, we probed Lee on world affairs and world leaders. Since he has personally known virtually all of the world's leaders over the last 50 years, we asked Lee about the qualities that distinguished the great ones from the bad ones and what he thought about those who were leading at the time. He rated Angela Merkel as the best leader in the West, and considered Vladimir Putin one of the best leaders worldwide. He explained that leaders must be judged within the circumstances they encounter, and then went on to share his view of how difficult it is to lead Russia and why he thought Putin was doing it well. He also reflected on his unique relationship with Deng Xiaoping, whom he regarded as the best leader of all. I love getting to know interesting people from interesting places and seeing the world through their eyes. This is true whether they are rich or poor. Seeing life through the eyes of the indigenous people I got to know in Papua New Guinea was as illuminating for me as gaining the perspectives of political and economic leaders, world-changing entrepreneurs, and cutting-edge scientists that I've spent time with. I'll never forget the blind man I met in a mosque in Syria who explained the Quran and his connection to God to me. Encounters like these have taught me that human greatness and terribleness are not correlated with wealth or other conventional measures of success. I've also learned that judging people before really seeing things through their eyes stands in the way of understanding their circumstances, and it isn't smart. I urge you to be curious enough to want to understand how the people who see things differently from you came to see them that way. You will find that interesting and invaluable, and the richer perspective you gain will help you decide what you should do. My family and my extended family. My family, my extended family of coworkers, and my work have all been extremely important to me. Juggling work and family has been as much a challenge to me as anyone else, especially since I wanted both to be great, so I combined them whenever I could. For example, I took my kids on business trips. When I first brought my son Devin and later Matt to my Chinese business meetings, our hosts were always very kind. For example, they would give them cookies and milk. One great memory from Abu Dhabi was when my clients and friends took my son Paul and me to the desert to eat freshly killed and roasted goat with our bare hands. I asked Paul, who was dressed in the traditional gown that they'd given him, how he liked it, and he said, "What could be better than to sit on the floor dressed in pajamas eating with my hands with nice people?" We all laughed. I remember another time when my eldest son, Devin, then about 10 years old, brought back silk scarves from China he'd bought for about $1 each and sold for $20 each in a shopping mall just before Christmas, which was just the first sign of his business savvy. By the mid-1980s, Bridgewater had grown to about 10 people, so I rented a big old farmhouse. Bridgewater occupied part of it, and my family occupied the rest. It was extremely informal and family-like. Everyone parked in the driveway, we met around the kitchen table, and my kids would leave the door open while they sat on the toilet, and the people I worked with would wave as they walked by. Eventually, the farm was put up for sale, so I bought a barn on the property and renovated it. My wife, our kids, eventually there were four, and I lived in a small apartment inside the barn, and I made the unfinished hayloft usable as an office by putting in electric baseboard heat, which I chose because it was the cheapest to install. It was a great space for parties, and there was enough land for us to play soccer and volleyball and have outdoor barbecues. For our company Christmas party, we'd have a big potluck dinner with my family. After a few drinks, Santa would show up and we would all sit on his lap for a photo and find out who'd been naughty and nice. The night always ended with a lot of dancing. We also had an annual sleaze day when everyone would dress up sleazy. You get the idea. Bridgewater was a small community of friends who worked hard and partied hard. Bob Prince joined Bridgewater in 1986 when he was still in his 20s, and over 30 years later, we are still close partners as well as chief investment officers. From the start, Bob and I played great jazz together whenever we'd go back and forth on ideas. We still love doing that, and we'll do that until one of us dies. He is also a great teacher, both to clients and coworkers. Over time, he became like my brother, as well as one of the most critical builders and pillars of Bridgewater. Soon, Bridgewater began to look like a real company. We outgrew the barn and moved into a small office in a strip mall. There were 20 of us by the end of the 1980s. But even as we grew, I never thought of anybody I worked with as an employee. I always wanted to have and be around people who also wanted to have a life full of meaningful work and meaningful relationships. And to me, a meaningful relationship is one that's open and honest in a way that lets people be straight with each other. I never valued more traditional, antiseptic relationships where people put on a facade of politeness and don't say what they really think. I believe that all organizations basically have two types of people: those who work to be part of a mission and those who work for a paycheck. I wanted to surround myself with people who needed what I needed, which was to make sense of things for myself. I spoke frankly, and I expected those around me to speak frankly. I fought for what I thought was best, and I wanted them to do that as well. When I thought someone did something stupid, I said so, and I expected them to tell me when I did something stupid. Each of us would be better for it. To me, that's what strong and productive relationships look like. Operating any other way would be unproductive and unethical. More big twists and turns in the economy and markets. 1987 and 1988 were filled with more of those big twists and turns that helped shape me and my approach to life and investing. We were one of the few investment managers who were short stocks ahead of Black Monday, October 19, 1987, then the largest single-day percentage decline in the history of the stock market. We got a lot of attention because we were up 22% when most others were down a lot. The media dubbed us as among the heroes of October. Naturally, I was feeling pretty good going into 1988. I had grown up in an era of high volatility and had learned that the best way to play it is to get a hold of a big move and ride it. We used our indicators to catch shifting fundamentals and our technical trend-following filters to confirm that the price movements were consistent with what the indicators were suggesting. When they both pointed in the same direction, we had a strong signal. When they were at odds, we had little or no signal. But as it turned out, there was hardly any volatility in 1988, so our technical filters whipsawed us, and we ended up giving back a bit more than half of our 1987 gains. That stung, but it also taught us some important lessons and prompted Bob and me to replace our technical trend-following filter with better value measures and risk controls. Until then, our systems had been completely discrete. In other words, they would flip from a fully long position to a fully short position when we crossed a predetermined threshold, much as we switched from bonds to cash for the World Bank. But we weren't always equally confident in our views, and we'd also get killed paying transaction costs when we crossed back and forth a lot. That drove Bob crazy. I can remember him running laps around the office building to calm himself down. So, at the end of the year, we moved to a more variable system that allowed us to size our bets in relationship to how confident we were. These and other improvements Bob made to our systems have paid off many times since. Not everyone at Bridgewater saw things as Bob and I did. Some of the company doubted that systemization could work, especially when the systems didn't do well, which, like normal decision-making, happened every now and then. It took a lot of reasoning to persuade some of the people I worked with to press on. But even if I couldn't convince them, they couldn't change my mind because they couldn't show me any good reason our approach of clearly specifying, testing, and systemizing our logic wasn't preferable to making decisions less systematically. All great investors and investment approaches have bad patches. Losing faith in them at such times is as common a mistake as getting too enamored with them when they do well. Because most people are more emotional than logical, they tend to overreact to short-term results. They give up and sell low when times are bad, and buy too high when times are good. I find this is just as true for relationships as it is for investments. Wise people stick with sound fundamentals through the ups and downs, while flighty people react emotionally to how things feel, jumping into things when they're hot and abandoning them when they're not. Despite our relatively poor investment performance, 1988 was a great year for Bridgewater because by reflecting on and learning from our poor performance, we made systematic improvements. I've come to realize that bad times coupled with good reflections provide some of the best lessons, and not just about business, but also about relationships. One has many more supposed friends when one is up than when one is down, because most people like to be with winners and shun losers. True friends are the opposite. I got a lot out of the bad times, not just because they gave me mistakes to learn from, but also because they helped me find out who my real friends were, the friends who would be with me through thick and thin. The next foothold for Bridgewater. As the 1980s came to an end, we were still a very small company with just 24 employees. Bob introduced me to Giselle Wagner in 1988. She would be my partner in running the non-investment side of the business for 20 years. Dan Bernstein and Ross Waller joined in 1988 and 1989 respectively, both fresh out of Dartmouth College. At the time, and for quite a while longer, I tended to hire people just out of school who didn't have much experience, but were smart, determined, and committed to the mission of making the company great. I didn't value experience as much as I valued character, creativity, and common sense, which I suppose was related to my having started Bridgewater 2 years out of school myself, and my belief that having an ability to figure things out is more important than having specific knowledge of how to do something. It seemed to me young people were creating sensible innovation that was exciting. Older folks who did things in the old ways held no appeal to me. I should add, though, that putting responsibility in the hands of inexperienced people doesn't always work out so well. Some painful lessons that you'll hear about later taught me that it could be a mistake to undervalue experience. By now, the initial $5 million from the World Bank had grown to $180 million in investments that we were managing for a variety of clients, but we were still trying to grab a larger foothold in the institutional investment business. When Rusty Olson, the chief investment officer of Kodak's pension fund, approached us to solve an investment problem, we jumped on the chance. Rusty was a remarkable innovator and a man of great character who started at Kodak in 1954 and took over the pension fund in 1972. He was widely respected as a leader in the pension fund world. We had been sending him our research for a while, and in 1990 he wrote us looking for an opinion on a big concern of his. The Kodak portfolio was heavily invested in equities, and Rusty was worried about what would happen in an environment in which the value of his assets fell badly. He had been trying to come up with a way to hedge himself against this risk without reducing his expected return. Rusty's fax arrived on Friday afternoon, and we leapt into action. Getting a client this prestigious and innovative would make a big difference to us. We knew we could do a uniquely great job for Kodak because we knew a lot about bonds and financial engineering, and we had a historical perspective unmatched in the industry. Bob Prince, Dan Bernstein, and I worked nonstop through the weekend, analyzing the Kodak portfolio and the strategy Rusty was considering. Then we wrote him a long memo laying out our thoughts. Just as I had deconstructed the business of a chicken producer in the 1970s, and many other companies since, we broke down Kodak's pension fund into its constituent parts to better understand the machine. Our proposed solutions drew on the portfolio engineering ideas that would later become core to Bridgewater's unique way of managing money. Rusty invited Bob and me to Rochester, and we came home with the $100 million account. That was a game changer. Not only did it bring us a lot of credibility, it provided us with a reliable source of revenue at a time we needed it. Discovering the Holy Grail of Investing. From my earlier failures, I knew that no matter how confident I was in making any one bet, I could still be wrong, and that diversification was the key to reducing risks without reducing returns. If I could build a portfolio filled with high-quality return streams that were properly diversified, in other words, they zigged and zagged in ways that balanced each other out, I could offer clients an overall portfolio return which was much more consistent and reliable than they would get elsewhere. Decades earlier, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Harry Markowitz had invented a widely used model that allowed one to input a set of assets with their expected returns, risks, and correlations, and determine an optimal mix of those assets in a portfolio. But his model didn't tell you anything about the incremental effects of changing any one of those variables, or how to handle being uncertain about those assumptions. By then, I was terribly fearful about what would happen if my assumptions were wrong, so I wanted to understand diversification in a very simple way. I asked Brian Gold, a recently graduated math major from Dartmouth who joined Bridgewater in 1990, to do a chart showing how the volatility of a portfolio would decline and its quality, as measured by the amount of return relative to the risk it would have, would improve if I incrementally added investments with different correlations. I'll explain all that in more detail in my Economic and Investment Principles. That simple chart struck me with the same force I imagined Einstein must have felt when he discovered E equals mc squared. I saw that with 15 to 20 good, uncorrelated return streams, I could dramatically reduce my risks without reducing my expected returns. It was so simple, but it would be such a breakthrough if the theory worked as well in practice as it did on paper. I called it the Holy Grail of Investing because it showed the path to making a fortune. This was another key moment in our education. The principle we discovered applies equally well to all ways of trying to make money. When you own a hotel, run a technology company, or do anything, your business produces a return stream. Having a few good uncorrelated return streams is better than having just one, and knowing how to combine return streams is even more effective than being able to choose good ones, though of course you have to do both. At the time, and still today, most investment managers didn't take advantage of this. They managed investments in a single asset class. Equity managers managed equities, bond managers managed bonds, and so on. Their clients gave them money with the expectation that they would receive the overall return of that asset class, such as the S&P Stock Market Price Index, plus some added returns from the bets the managers took to overweigh or underweigh particular assets, such as buying more of Microsoft stock rather than the index and less of something else. But individual assets within an asset class are generally about 60% correlated with each other, which means they go up or down together more than half the time. As the Holy Grail concept conveyed, an equity manager could put 1,000 60% correlated stocks into their portfolio, and it wouldn't provide much more diversification if they picked only 5. It would be easy to beat those guys by balancing our bets in the way the chart indicated. Thanks to my process of systematically recording my investment principles and the results they could be expected to produce, I had a large collection of uncorrelated return streams. In fact, I had something like 1,000 of them. Because we traded a number of different asset classes, and within each one we had programmed and tested a lot of fundamental trading rules, we had many more high-quality ones to choose from than a typical manager who was tracking a smaller number of assets and was probably not trading systematically. I worked with Bob and Dan to pull our best decision rules from the pile. Once we had them, we back-tested them over long time frames, using the systems to simulate how the decision rules would have worked together in the past. We were startled by the results. On paper, this new approach improved our returns by a factor of 3 to 5 times per unit of risk, and we could calibrate the amount of return we wanted based on the amount of risk we could tolerate. In other words, we could make a ton more money than the other guys with lower risk of being knocked out of the game, as I'd nearly been before. I called it the killer system because it would either produce killer results for us and our clients, or it would kill us because we were missing something important. The success of this approach taught me a principle that I apply to all parts of my life. Making a handful of good uncorrelated bets that are balanced and leveraged well is the surest way of having a lot of upside without being exposed to unacceptable downside. As excited as we were about this new approach, we proceeded cautiously. We gave the system a 10% weight initially, and it made money in 19 of 20 months in our test period. As we got more confident, I decided to reach out to a select group of investors I knew about investing in a strategy with just $1 million trial accounts. I knew that asking these institutional investors to invest such a relatively modest amount would make it hard for them to turn us down. I called the new product Top 5% at first, because it comprised the best 5% of our decision rules. Later, I changed the name to Pure Alpha to convey that it consisted purely of alphas. Because Pure Alpha didn't have any betas, it didn't have any biases to go up or down with any market. Its returns depended only on how good we were at outperforming others. Our totally new alpha overlay approach allowed investors to receive the return of their chosen asset class, for example, the S&P stock market, a bond index, commodities, whatever, plus the return the portfolio of the bets were making across all asset classes. As unprecedented as our approach was, we explained the logic carefully, showing why it actually made so much more sense than traditional investment approaches. We also showed them how we expected the cumulative performance to unfold and what the expected range of performance around that would be. For our clients, it was a bit like being presented with the design of a plane that had never flown before, but looked radically better than other planes on paper. Would anyone be courageous enough to get on board? Some clients got the concepts and were excited to change the rules. Others didn't understand or worked for organizations that refused to try cutting-edge new things. Frankly, we were thrilled that any of them were willing to try. For over 26 years now, that new type of plane has flown exactly as we anticipated, making money in 23 of these years and having only 3 years of modest losses, making more money in total for our clients than any other hedge fund ever. While the investment management concepts that underlie Pure Alpha eventually changed our industry, the journey from conception to general acceptance took many years of learning and grinding work by a group of dedicated partners. Getting our killer system out into the world. Pure Alpha represented the best way we knew to actively manage money. But we also knew that if we wanted to manage a meaningful amount of institutional money, we had to accept the reality that only a limited number of innovative clients would try this approach. So while we tried to convince clients to adopt our way, by the end of the 1990s and into the early 2000s, Pure Alpha made up only about 10% of our total assets under management. Even though we couldn't trade stocks and commodities in our pure bond accounts, we applied the portfolio structuring principles we discovered and used with Pure Alpha to give our bond clients higher returns at lower risks. This included trading foreign government bonds, emerging market debt, inflation-linked bonds, corporate bonds, and the currency exposures that came with the foreign investments. In our most unconstrained portfolios, we would make about 50 different types of bets, way more than traditional bond managers traded. Doing so gave us a big edge and landed us at the top of many investment performance tables year after year. Our Pure Alpha product was just the first of a number of innovative designs we brought to our clients. In 1991, we had become the first currency overlay manager for institutional investors. At the time, institutional investors were placing large portions of their portfolios into global equity and bond markets. While investing internationally added valuable diversity, it also added unmanaged currency exposure. This was a big problem because the currency exposures added risks without adding any expected return. We had traded currencies for years and had developed expertise in portfolio engineering, so we were in a prime position to solve this problem for them. Eventually, we became the largest active currency manager in the world. We also produced several other new and effective ways of managing money that flew exactly as they were designed. With each one, we gave clients clearly stated performance expectations expressed in a chart that showed an accumulated profit line and the expected variations around that line. We could do this because the systemization of our decision-making process allowed us to stress test the performance of our decision-making under a wide range of conditions. Systemizing our learning from mistakes. Of course, we continued to make mistakes, though they were all within our range of expectations. What was great is that we made the most of our mistakes because we got in the habit of viewing them as opportunities to learn and improve. One of the most memorable mistakes happened in the early 1990s when Ross, who was in charge of trading at the time, forgot to put in a trade for a client and the money just sat there in cash. By the time the mistake was discovered, the damage was several hundred thousand dollars. It was a terribly costly error, and I could have done something dramatic like fire Ross to set a tone that mistakes would not be tolerated. But since mistakes happen all the time, that would have only encouraged people to hide theirs, which would have led to even bigger and more costly errors. I believed strongly that we should bring problems and disagreements to the surface to learn what should be done to make things better. So Ross and I built out an error log in the trading department. From then on, any time there was any kind of bad outcome, such as a trade wasn't executed or we paid a significantly higher transaction cost than we expected, the traders would make a record of it and we would follow up. As we consistently tracked and addressed those issues, our trade execution machine continually improved. Having a process that ensures problems are brought to the surface and their root causes are diagnosed assures that continual improvements occur. For that reason, I insisted that an issue log be adopted throughout Bridgewater. My rule was simple. If something went badly, you had to put it in a log, characterize its severity, and make clear who was responsible for it. If a mistake happened and you logged it, you were okay. If you didn't log it, you would be in deep trouble. This way, managers had problems brought to them, which was worlds better than having to seek them out. The error log, which we now call the issue log, was our first management tool. I learned subsequently how important tools are in helping to reinforce desired behaviors, which led us to create a number of tools that I will describe later. This culture of bringing problems and disagreements to the surface generated a lot of discomfort and conflict, especially when it came to exploring people's weaknesses. Before long, things came to a boil. My intractable people problem. One winter day in 1993, Bob, Giselle, and Dan proposed taking me out to dinner with the stated purpose of giving Ray feedback about how he affects people and company morale. They sent me a memo first, the gist of which was that my way of operating was having a negative effect on everybody in the company. Here's how they put it. What does Ray do well? He is very bright and innovative. He understands markets and money management. He is intense and energetic. He has very high standards and passes those to others around him. He has good intentions about teamwork, building group ownership, providing flexible work conditions to employees, and compensating people well. What doesn't he do well? Ray sometimes says or does things to employees which makes them feel incompetent, unnecessary, humiliated, overwhelmed, belittled, oppressed, or otherwise bad. The odds of this happening rise when Ray is under stress. At these times, his words and actions toward others create animosity toward him and leave a lasting impression. The impact of this is that people are demotivated rather than motivated. This reduces productivity and the quality of the environment. The effect reaches far beyond the single employee. The smallness of the company and the openness of communication means that everyone is affected when one person is demotivated, treated badly, not given due respect. The future success of the company is highly dependent on Ray's ability to manage people as well as money. If he doesn't manage people well, growth will be stunted and we all will be affected. Ugh, that hurt and surprised me. I never imagined that I was having that sort of effect. These people were my extended family. I didn't want them to feel incompetent, unnecessary, humiliated, overwhelmed, belittled, oppressed, or otherwise bad? Why didn't they tell me these things directly? What was I doing wrong? Were my standards too high? For Bridgewater to continue to be a 1 in 10,000 type company, we had to have exceptional people and hold them to extremely high standards. Was I demanding too much? This looked to me like another one of those fork-in-the-road cases in which I had to choose between two seemingly essential but mutually exclusive options. One being radically truthful with each other, including probing to bring our problems and weaknesses to the surface so we could deal with them forthrightly. And the other being having happy and satisfied employees. And it reminded me that when faced with a choice between two things you need and that are seemingly at odds, go slowly to figure out how you can have as much as possible of both. There is almost always a good path that you just haven't figured out yet. So look for it until you find it, rather than settle for the choice that is then apparent to you. My first step was to make sure I knew exactly what the problems were and how to handle them. So I asked Bob, Giselle, and Dan what they thought was going on. I learned that they personally, and many others who knew me well, weren't as demoralized by me as some others because they understood my heart was in a good place. If they hadn't known that, they would have quit because, as they put it, I wasn't paying them enough money to put up with my crap. They knew that I wanted the best for them in Bridgewater, and to get it, I needed to be radically truthful with them, and I needed them to be radically truthful with me. This wasn't only because it produced better results, but also because being radically truthful with each other was fundamental to how I believed we should be with each other. We agreed that being this way was essential, but since it was making some people feel bad, something had to change. While those people I had contact with understood me, liked me, and in some cases loved me, those who had less contact with me were offended by my directness. It was clear that I needed to be better understood and to understand others better. I realized then how essential it was that people in relationships must be crystal clear about their principles for dealing with each other. That began our decades-long process of putting our principles into writing, which you'll hear about later when we get into the work principles. These principles were both agreements for how we would be with each other and my reflections of how we should handle every situation that came up. Since most types of situations arose repeatedly with slight variations, these principles were continually refined. As for our agreements with each other, the most important one was our need to do three things. First, put our honest thoughts on the table. Second, have thoughtful disagreements in which people are willing to shift their opinions as they learn. And third, have agreed upon ways of deciding if disagreements remain so that we could move beyond them without resentments. I believe that for any organization or for any relationship to be great, these things are required. I also believe that for a group decision-making system to be effective, the people using it have to believe that it's fair. Having our work principles written out and getting in sync about them in the same way we had done for our investment principles were essential for our understanding each other, especially since our unique way of operating, with this radical truthfulness and this radical transparency, led to our unique results in counterintuitive and emotionally challenging ways for some people. Trying to understand how we could get our meaningful work and meaningful relationships through this straightforwardness led me to speak to neuroscientists, psychologists, and educators over the decades that followed. I learned a lot, which I can summarize in a very simple way. Basically, there are two parts in each person's brain, the upper level logical part and the lower level emotional part. I call these the two U's. They fight for control of each person. How that conflict is managed is the most important driver of our behaviors. It turns out that that fighting was the biggest reason for the problems Bob, Giselle, and Dan raised. While the logical part of people's brains could easily understand that knowing one's weakness is a good thing, because it's the first step toward getting around them, the emotional part typically hates it.